KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we meet Bay Area Muslim women who have achieved success in the world of work and retain their religious beliefs and practices. We'll hear how they feel they do or don't fit in, and we'll talk with them about some of the differences between Islam in the Asian countries they hail from and Islam in the countries of the Middle East. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. There are presently 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide, and 6 to 8 million live right here in the United States, and Americans are converting to Islam at the rate of 20,000 each year, with women outnumbering men 4-1. We wanted to talk to some Bay Area Muslim women this hour, not converts and not Muslims from the Arab world. We've asked four practicing Muslim women from Asian countries because much less is heard or read about them than about their female counterparts in the Arab world. And the four women, three Sunni and one Shia, are all women who have had successes in the business or professional worlds. And let me tell you who we have assembled with us this hour. We want to welcome, first of all, Farhana Kara, who is Executive Director of Muslim Advocates. They're a charitable organization dedicated to advocacy and education to serve the needs of the Muslim American community. We welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also here in studio with us is Amra Tareen, a venture capitalist, also funder of and CEO of All Voices, a new social media site. The goal of All Voices is to create an unmediated global community that shares news, videos, images, and opinions. And good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And also with us here in studio this morning is Diane Alyan, and she's founder and president of Give Light Foundation, a crisis relief organization that seeks to create durable orphanages in response to natural disaster. She's also outreach director at the Muslim Community Association in Santa Clara and former associate director at Procter & Gamble, and is launching a clothing line for Muslim women. And welcome to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have you all here. Also with us, Shahiroz Jarnia is Director of Product Strategy with Jaja. It's a telecommunications startup funded by Sequoia Capital, Intel Capital, and Deutsche Telekom. And she's also founder of Women 2.0, which promotes the collaboration and growth of women in entrepreneurship. And good morning to you.
Thank you for having us.
That's some high-powered women here, to be sure. I'm going to begin with Farhana Kara, who, as I should mention, worked in the Senate Judiciary Committee and actually worked with Russ Feingold, Senator Russ Feingold, focused on the Patriot Act and has done a lot of work with civil rights and civil rights legislation. Different world after 9/11 for not only all of that, but for Muslim women in general. Let's talk about that to start.
Sure. As you mentioned, Michael, I worked with Senator Feingold starting in 1999 and actually was with him, still working with him on the day of those tragic events on September 11th, and worked for several years after that until the end of 2004. And for me, maybe just to start and tell you a little bit about me, I was born and raised in upstate New York, the child of immigrant parents from Pakistan. And for the most part, growing up, I would say my education and my professional pursuits were probably not too unremarkable for the child of immigrant parents. You know, the early goals set by my parents were to pursue an education and a stable career. And for me, in part, social justice, civil rights causes quickly became something that was near and dear to my heart because even as a young woman growing up in upstate New York and then going off to college and seeing really the contrast in experiences that I was having, being able to have these experiences in the U.S. in contrast to my relatives in Pakistan, and particularly my female relatives, I became kind of acutely aware, even as a teenager, of the remarkable opportunities that the United States was giving me and my family to pursue an education. In contrast to many of my own relatives who are illiterate or have very minimal education. So the cause of social justice was something that I think quickly became very near and dear to my heart. And then I guess fast forwarding to September 11th, that was a time where here I was working on the Senate Judiciary Committee, advising Senator Feingold on a range of issues, from the death penalty to reproductive rights to gay rights issues. And suddenly, on that day and in the weeks and months thereafter, suddenly the most pressing civil rights challenges facing our nation were actually challenges facing my community, my particular ethnic and faith community. So where previously here I was sitting around the table talking about issues like racial profiling with our allies in the NAACP, with the National Council of La Raza, suddenly it was my community that was now in the
literally hit home.
So
yeah.
It did.
When you talk about your involvement in civil rights, though, I'm interested in your response to, well, the sense that many have that it's an unfair and disproportionate world that Muslim women live in. And particularly, in fact, I was thinking just in the last hour, we were talking about gay marriages as a civil right and so forth, gay and lesbian marriages. Muslim men, as I understand it, can marry Christian or Jewish women, but Muslim women can only marry Muslim men.
I am a lawyer by training, but let me just say this as a prefatory matter. I do not consider myself an Islamic legal scholar, so I cannot
give. But you're practicing.
I'm practicing. Yeah, right. And so just as I can tell you generally, though, I think, I think the traditional interpretation that that's true, I think there are some folks who are starting to interpret that in a much broader way and believe that that women certainly have the right to marry Christians and Jews, people of the book, much like men do as well. So I think there's some evolution in that regard, and particularly in the United States, where it is a very diverse, very pluralistic societies, and where as our communities here longer and longer, we are becoming increasingly integrated in all the various ways that that means, and that includes interfaith marriage.
So you're hopeful in general, not only about that, but about the status of women and the equality of women where the Muslim community is concerned?
I am still very hopeful on the large scale, both in the United States as well as in the broader Muslim world, that the broad trajectory is is one of progression. And in some ways, I actually feel like American Muslim women have a special role to play, because I do think that our country gives us the opportunity to really debate these issues and think freely, to really have very critical, robust debates about Islamic jurisprudence and about all of these issues. So I really think there's an opportunity here for the American Muslim community to lead and to help empower our fellow sisters around the world.
You've had no personal encounters with discrimination because of being Muslim?
I have not, but I certainly have friends and family and know scores of people who have.
Again, we're talking with Farhana Kara, who is Executive Director of Muslim Advocates, and Amra Tareen is also with us. She's a venture capitalist, MBA from Harvard, and is about to launch this new website, allvoices.com, which we'll talk about. But she grew up in Pakistan and Australia, and a lot of what you are about is being an advocate for women, especially women where entrepreneurship is concerned.
Absolutely. And, you know, I left venture capital to start All Voices. So I am looking forward to launching the company. And as a venture capitalist, I used to be, not a lot of women entrepreneurs in general go out and start companies. So having a Muslim woman who was in the corporate world in the United States and then a venture capitalist funded companies. And now I'm a founder CEO of a media company, which is not my background because I'm a technologist at heart. And I'm looking forward to giving voices to people all around the world. And All Voices is the first open media company that anyone on the planet can actually share their news with the rest of the world. We are totally unedited by humans. We use technology and citizen reporting all around the world. So that's what I'm passionate about. And just to give you why I wanted to do that, it was after 9/11. My personal story is that I always believed religion was something personal to people. It was nothing that you had to wear on your sleeves. But after 9/11, I just saw the environment in the United States changed. And there was no discussion going on about war, why we wanted to go to war with Iraq. Media was marching to the beat of war. Muslim community was silenced because of the fear of retaliation. And if you believed in something else, you were considered unpatriotic. So I wanted a place for discussion because I believe no matter, it depends on where you are located, your geography, that you have certain points of view. And All Voices is the culmination of that, where anyone can share. We put all the different types of voices together for
that could mean extreme voices too, then, could it?
Yes, extreme voices. It could mean that as well. And it will depend on the community. The community will decide which voices get heard and which don't. But everyone has a voice on All Voices.
How important is it to, for example, follow the kind of customs? We're going to talk shortly with Diane, who's here with us in studio, who wears a hijab. You don't, and none of the other women do. I mean, these debates go on, and they will continue to go on all over the world. I mean, in Europe, in the United States, especially in Canada. How important is that outer sense of being identified as a Muslim woman?
Okay. So Michael, interesting enough, as you said, I grew up on three continents, Asia, Australia, and United States. So my family moved to Australia when I was a teenager. And growing up in Pakistan, I did not see a single woman wear a hijab. When I went to Australia, it was the first time as a teenager I saw Muslim women wearing a hijab. To me, it was, okay, maybe there are, you know, Muslim nuns or something. And then when I came to the United States, I saw more Muslim women wearing the hijab. So I think it's a personal choice for a Muslim woman. In Islam, it's for women to dress modestly. And you see me, I've got a business suit on. So I dress modestly, but I am a little materialistic, so I do wear jewelry. But to me, hijab was not part of growing up as a Muslim girl in Pakistan.
I remember when I interviewed Mrs. Budo years ago, and she came in with kind of a nice suit like you're wearing and a lot of jewelry and no hijab. And I started to say this off the air, and she said, please don't mention it on the air. I mean, there's a sense, in other words, of working within your community and being recognized in your community one way as opposed to perhaps your public self. And, well, let's talk with Dion Alian, who has a hijab, because that sense of your outer identity is important to you, or how significant is it?
I have not always had hijab, so I decided to put it on after I went to perform pilgrimage in Mecca. And I did that right after I left my corporate world with Procter & Gamble. And it was the most humbling experience. I never felt so insignificant in my life.
You did the Hajj.
I did the Hajj.
Yeah.
And that was right after I said I left my work with P&G. And at that time, I just started searching for my soul. You know, what is my place? What is my place in this universe? And right after that, I decided to put it on. And to me, it is more a certain of identity. And I grew up in a country,
Indonesia,
which is the largest Muslim country in the world.
Yes.
And I grew up in a household where Islam was practiced with love and devotion, but the subject of hijab was never brought up. My parents never imposed on me to wear a hijab because, after all, it is just something that you use to cover your hair, right? So if your heart is not connected to God, if you don't even follow the pillars of Islam, the five pillars, why even bother putting that?
Some say it's very hard to follow those five pillars, particularly for professional, busy women like you. I mean, you have to pray five times a day, pretty much, don't you? Or
yes.
Make sure that you pray at predicted times. Hard to do in the workplace. I mean, this represents a lot of issues. Just, I can imagine working in a place like Procter & Gamble and suddenly you go off to pray. And
I think Islam is designed not to complicate your life. It is something that actually will set the rhythm of your life. And I remember when I first moved to the States, my boss actually is a Jew. And I used to tell him, Jeff, I need to pray five times a day, and two of them are going to happen here in the workplace. So I used to go to his office and pray.
But when you did the Hajj, you felt a higher sense of purpose. I mean,
that's
pretty clear. And you began to, well, we should mention that you lost 40 members of your family to the tsunami.
Yes.
And you became very dedicated to helping orphans. And this is your life work now.
Yes. I look at my life, I feel like I am really blessed that God has fulfilled for me all of my cherished dreams. So to me, I ask myself, what have I done above and beyond what is required of me to thank him for all the blessings in my life? And I live now in Silicon Valley, the center of money, center of technology, center of innovation, and I'm surrounded by people with access resources.
And I also represent a world where people live in poverty. And I've seen them with my own eyes. After the tsunami, you went back. Despite of the millions of dollars that are pouring into the region, you will see people living in barracks and tents with no water, sharing a house with 40 families. How can I go on with my life pretending that I don't see those? And if you look at the Quran, in the Quran, there are many verses in the Quran that talks about helping the poor and the needy, especially the orphans, Because if you look at the life of our prophet, peace be upon him, he was an orphan. He lost his father before he was even born. And then he lost his mother. And then he lost his grandfather. So orphan has a special place in the hearts of Muslims. And you can talk to any Muslims. There's no question about that.
Well, I commend you for the work you do. And it can be obviously tied to your religious beliefs and is tied to your religious beliefs. And we're talking to Dion Alyan, who is founder and president of Give Light Foundation, a crisis relief organization that creates durable orphanages in response to natural disasters like the tsunami. Also with us this morning is Shaharoz Charnia, who is director of product strategy for Jaja, a telecommunications startup. And this is... again, you also started this, founded this Women 2.0, so the whole sense of doing things for women is very important to you, too. And how does this come out of your Muslim background?
Interestingly enough, it comes from sort of the growing up with the ethic of always giving back. I've always felt that I've been given freedom, I've been given education. And being a Muslim, it's been taught that if you save the life of one man or one woman, it's as if you've saved the entirety of mankind. And feeling that and knowing that has always forced me to think a little bit beyond about what I can do. I've been given that opportunity to give back, so why don't I encourage others to also do the same? And when I meet women in tech, which is another minority, which is a whole other discussion in itself, they don't necessarily feel like they can take their idea to the next level. And so Women 2.0 was actually born out of the idea to have more women start companies. And if more women are starting companies, and then I think the world would be a better place because they're pursuing their dreams.
You only pray three times a day. This is your brand of Islam, right?
Correct.
I mean, it's actually has a different name, in fact.
Correct. I'm a Shia Ismaili Muslim. There are 15 million of us around the world in 25 different countries. We pledge our allegiance to His Highness the Prince Karim Aga Khan, and who is the direct descendant of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And that's correct. We tend to pray three times a day. That's correct.
It's also the difference between we're talking about your Islamic background going back. Well, you've spent many years in Canada, I know,
correct.
But going back to India, really, where your family roots are, and looking at something that came out of the RAND Corporation, who do these kinds of studies, and they say non-Arab sectors of the Muslim world are more politically inclusive, boast the majority of democratic or partially democratic governments, and are more secular in outlook. Although the Middle East has traditionally been regarded as the core of the Muslim world, it appears that the gravity may be shifting for non-Arab sectors. Essentially, what they're arguing is that the Arab world has a very different kind of approach to Islam, that you're less apt in Asia versions of Islam to see as much progressive ideas or democracy and so forth. Generally, to address that, if you would.
Sure. And I encourage all of us to join in that discussion. When you think of the Arab world, there's a lot of things that are actually culturally rooted. And when it comes, for example, to the hijab or practicing that, not only were women who were of high rank in the Muslim world wearing hijabs in the Arab world, but so were Christians and so were Jews, and that is the case even today. When you think of some of the the privileges that were written in the Quran, it was written in the context of an Arab world at the time where actually the English women were not given any rights at that time. And so to give a woman some inheritance or the ability to divorce, which was written in the Quran, that was huge. So, you know, things can be taken out of context, and so culture also impacts the way you practice your faith.
Well, there are some, in fact, who argue that the idea that there's discrimination against women certainly may be true in some interpretations of the Quran or some practices, but there's also the hijab and this and burqas and things that sort of protecting women from being objectified. There's a whole sense, in other words, of the argument that there's an ethical standard of women not being sexualized and being treated with great respect because they are women. I mean, again, depending on who's doing the interpreting or who's rendering. I don't know if any of you want to sort of step up to the plate here, so to speak, and address that whole issue, because it's an ongoing issue of great concern to Muslim women and to Muslims in general.
I think we talked about this earlier, that addressing modestly is a religious injunction for both men and women. And the Quran mentioned that. But the details, I think, is left to your own interpretation. And I think that's one of the beauty of Islam, is that it leaves some room for a diversity of thoughts. In other words, God doesn't say to you, this is how you have to do it in the Quran, but there's the sunnah and there's the practices of the scholars and whatnot. So again, it is not, the basics are there, but the details are left to your interpretation that allows people to interpret in different ways. But
well, there's a sense of great diversity here.
Exactly,
is what you're
diversity of thoughts. And even today, we have four women here, one cover and four don't. And if you look at the statistic of the Muslim women around the world, I don't know what it is, maybe 50% covers and 50% don't, and it will be maybe like that till the end of the world.
Well, what I was fascinated in seeing was I was looking at something called Muslim Girl Magazine, which is now out in print and digital, and they cover up and they have hijabs and so forth, but there's an emphasis on glamour, there's Muslim cheerleaders, there's all-girl Muslim proms that are all girls because, you know, the idea of taking a male to a prom seems to abridge certain moral distinctions. In fact, Dion, you're launching a clothing line, you said.
Yes.
So along these lines with a kind of Americanized fashion?
I think for me, I want it to look stylish. I've always loved to dress well, and I don't want wearing the hijab to take that sense of style. So how do you present yourself in a way that is professional, stylish, that is compatible with your Islamic identity?
Well, in the magazine, seeing Muslim Girl Scout troops, I mean, a lot of this has to do with American identity and the identity of being a Muslim kind of conjoining or really being synthesized in some ways. That's a challenge for many of you, isn't it? I mean,
No, it's not.
It's just a natural part of, and it doesn't present any challenges at all?
When it comes to, I guess, externalizing the faith, what's interesting is when I'm sitting at my startup and coming up with a new product spec at 4 o'clock in the morning in time for my developers in Tel Aviv to get, you know, the specs, I feel that that is a sense of externalizing or practicing my faith, because I'm building, for, in my opinion, a product that's going to lower the cost of global communications. And so when I think of, you know, how to, you know, she's building a clothing line, but I'm sitting here dedicating my life to giving back and giving back through business and giving back through business that actually creates a difference in the world. That feels like practicing my faith no matter what, whether I'm bowing down to the floor or not. That's for me.
Not bowing down to mammon by banking profits and all that, huh?
Exactly.
No. Listen, I'm going to open the phone lines. I know there are many who would like to join us in our conversation here. We're talking with a group of local Muslim American women who have started social or business ventures and finding about their lives and their careers and common misconceptions about their faith, like the one that maybe you don't have any kind of dissonance between being an American or living in the United States and practicing that faith. And also, former member of the Senate Judiciary Committee as a lawyer, I should mention that Farhana Kara is a Harvard lawyer and Cornell lawyer, excuse me, and has practiced, as we said, with Senator Feingold's office. So I'm going to open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us with any questions or comments you might have. A lot of things to talk about here, certainly, and our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, your call's welcome right now, 866-733-6786, or send us an email, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. When we return, we'll hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with a quartet of local Muslim American women who have started social or business ventures, and also talking with an attorney and executive director of Muslim Advocates, Farhana Kara, also with us in studio, Amra Tareen, and Dina Alyan, and Shahiroz Charnia. And we're going to go to your calls here forthwith in a moment. I want to just mention, though, that There is all this. Let's talk a bit about some American misconceptions before we go to calls. I guess something that's not a misconception is that there's a dearth of male suitors for young Muslim women. At least this is what I read.
I haven't found them. Where are they?
Hey, I married a white American who converted and became a Muslim.
I married an Egyptian.
Yeah.
Muslim.
So it's tough out there for some of the ladies. But there's also this sense that if you are an obedient Muslim, you have a stringent morality, and you have almost a sense of, and being a woman, difficulty in navigating through those kind of channels. So let's talk about that at least for a moment. I mean, the expression on your face, Cheryl Rose, which people can't see, is one of, you know, it's really not this way.
Exactly.
And this is the stereotype. And so demolish it.
Go ahead. So I grew up in Canada, and I would say a model country for pluralism, where growing up, I was never asked, you know, what are you doing at 7 o'clock? Oh, you're going for prayers. That's great. You know, I had Jewish friends. I had Christian friends. I had other Muslim friends. And it just, these things never came up. We were accepting and curious in a very positive way as to what we were doing. But it was never anything negative. I moved to America. Not only am I a minority in the tech world as a female, okay, I'm a minority in the tech world as a young female. Okay, now I'm a minority as a Shia in here in the U.S., and the questions I get are a little different now. And it's out of ignorance.
People ask you about, like, honor killings and...
Not at all.
Hymens restored and things like that.
I've never been asked that question. And I guess the real questions are is, you know, okay, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Canada. Okay, where are you really from? My parents are from India and Pakistan. Oh, that's great. So, you know, do you pray 5 times a day? And, you know, you talk about your practices, and that's about as far as it goes. I command respect when I'm in the workplace. I command respect with my friends. And you get that in return when you're in a meritocratic society like the U.S., if you're doing good work, these questions don't come up. You know, people take you for who you are and the work that you do.
And you also have experienced no personal discrimination because of being Muslim?
No.
Nobody here has?
No,
I haven't either. I think there is a hidden discrimination, but I think you have to be very thick-skinned to be a woman in business. And then being a Muslim on top, absolutely.
So it's different. The glass ceiling of being a woman is tougher in some ways, is what you're saying.
Oh, I actually agree with that. It is to a certain extent, from just as you've seen the Democratic primaries. So I think it is tougher being a woman as opposed to a Muslim woman.
I mean, 10% of female executives in startups, tech startups, only 10% are either CEO or co-founder level. I mean, I wonder why, when 50% of U.S. businesses are actually female owned.
But I will say that the way I am is because I am a Muslim woman, because I'm tough, I'm very disciplined, and my religion makes me very disciplined. I'm forgiving, I'm tolerant, and, you know, I really believe in justice for all. That's why I've started this company, where you want to make sure it's about democracy, and I believe Islam is about democracy. And that's who I am. And from my upbringing, education's been very key, which is part of my religion. That, you know, and Muhammad used to tell people to go to China from the Saudi Arabia to go to China for education. So, you know, my parents made me an electrical engineer, computer scientist, Harvard MBA, go out there, slay dragons, work, be independent. And that's, to me, is being a Muslim. And, you know, when people say, oh, you're a Muslim woman, you should stay at home, you should cover your hair, you shouldn't go out. Well, I went to the tribal areas of Pakistan during the election time just a few months ago. And you know what I found in the tribal areas that are dangerous? The tribal elders want their daughters to be educated because they want development for their young, whether they're girls or women. There was a woman whose husband was killed by a suicide bomber who was running for an election in the tribal areas, everything covered except her eyes, I could see. So, you know, there is this movement that women need to be more independent and stand on their feet. That's
some of the Taliban should read, or of those turns of mind, should read the Quran, because there is a lot about female equality in the Quran.
Sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And these are proud women we're hearing here, proud about being Muslims and also believers in the American dream. I mean, that's the subtext I'm hearing here in this discussion.
I wanted to also add to what Amra was saying earlier about the importance of education. In fact, the first verse that was revealed to the Prophet, peace be upon him, was Iqra, which means read. Read in the name of your Lord. So knowledge, seeking knowledge is of utmost importance in Islam. And I remember growing up, my parents told me there are only two things you need to worry about. First is to excel in education. Second is to worship God. If you do these two things, you will go far. You can go to the end of the world and conquer the world. And I truly believe that.
Yeah, on a related note, believing in the American dream, I mean, I came here with a backpack, two backpacks, one backpack with clothes, the other one with books, but I don't read. I opened up a line of credit and I said, I want to be in the Silicon Valley where there's innovation. I want to learn about that innovation and take it and give back. So obtaining knowledge was always part of my life. And so coming across the border with the intention to be a visitor for 3 months, but of course wanting to stay here to pursue that American dream, to give back with whatever business knowledge and ability I could, is who I am. And it comes from my faith.
Did you pursue that in Canada?
100%. However, one-third of the world's venture capital money is in Silicon Valley. Or sorry, one-third of the North American venture capital money.
If you're not in California, you won't get funding.
No, thank you.
A VC, you have to be in the third. I used to be in the 30 miles.
And preferably a certain area around Menlo
Exactly.
Park or Saratoga.
You got it. So Canada. And actually, I want
to
share something personal with you and your listeners, because education is so important. So, you know, me, when I was hitting my 20s, my parents were getting worried that I need to get married. And I had all these proposal and arranged marriages coming in. And for me, it was talking to my dad, no, I want to study more. I want to do now get a business degree. So education for me was one way of not committing to anyone for an arranged marriage.
It was your way out.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to find our way into some calls here. And in fact, we're going to go to Menlo Park first and welcome Sarah. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Can hear you fine.
Wonderful. I admire these ladies that they've been all educated and professional. Also, I am the person who was raised in one of Muslim country as a woman, and I'm educated, and I'm in United States now. But we owe to Muslim women in the world. I'm not Muslim anymore. We owe to the Muslim women in the world to bring the truth right now. If somebody liked to be educated and had an open-minded father and was given that option, that doesn't make any difference for one woman who lived in Muslim country. The first thing that woman doesn't have is an option in Islam, which means you cannot change your religion because you've been born from Muslim father. They are talking about Muhammad, but the same person that they are talking about, when he was 20 years old, he married 40 years old woman because that woman was rich. And the same man, Muhammad, was married to 9 years old woman when he was 6 years old because that woman was pretty. So that's the man we are following.
Well, Farhana, some thoughts from you.
Now, excuse me,
before you go on, I want to hear from Farhana Kara.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think the callers, it sounds like the caller is somebody who grew up Muslim, but is no longer Muslim and has fallen away. And yeah, I obviously don't want to get into the reasons for that. I don't think we have the time on the show to delve into that. But I do think the caller in her first set of comments did make a good point that because particular individuals may have had strong parents who supported them, supported me, perhaps my guests on the show this morning, to have an education, can that be true that that's true of all Muslim women? I think the key there is that we definitely need to make progress in the Muslim world, broadly speaking. I think we do need to continue to, and I think a lot of progress has been made over the decades, but we still need to push forward and continue to educate our own fellow Muslims. And this is both Muslim men and Muslim women, Muslim mothers and fathers, about the value of education and that it's a really an Islamic obligation to educate both your sons and your daughters. And so I think there's work to be done in that regard. But it's also, you know, unfortunately, I think it's true of I think there are other forces at play, as in other parts of the developing world, where there are economic conditions at play that also filter into families' decisions about the ways in which and they do decide to pursue education for their children. But I think these are issues that need to be addressed. And I would not kind of put the blame, so to speak, on an entire faith because of particular social conditions.
Sarah, did you have something you wanted to add here? Well, I guess not. Okay, we'll go to some more calls here. A lot of Americans also have the notion that Sharia is very strict and, you know, very demanding in terms of, obedience and following the laws, and laws that sometimes are viewed in the West, particularly after 9/11, as being extreme. Some thoughts from any of you on that?
Do you want me to jump in?
Yeah, go ahead,
says the lawyer.
We get the lawyer.
I am a lawyer.
Here, yeah, right. The
although I'm a lawyer in the American legal system, I am not trained in Sharia or in Islamic jurisprudence. But having said that, my understanding of the state of Sharia is that it should be a dynamic body, and there should be a dynamic interpretation of Sharia, of Islamic law. And the problem over the last couple of centuries or so is that dynamic evolving interpretation of Islamic law has not been occurring for the most part. We are slowly but surely are developing, a number of different Islamic legal scholars around the world, including here in the United States, who are starting to really to do the kind of very deep look at the Sharia and see what it means in terms of how do you live your life in today and today's times. And so I think there definitely needs to be work done, and work is being done in that regard.
You might recall that the Archbishop of Canterbury made a statement that it'll be inevitable that English law, common law, will somehow be conjoined with Sharia, and there was intense criticism. I mean, you know, you would have thought that he had become an infidel or something along those lines, where many Europeans, and particularly British people in the UK, were concerned. I presume, particularly with your legal experience and what you say is your American expertise in jurisprudence, you would want to keep church and state or mosque and state separate.
Yes, and I would say, you know, I would say broadly speaking, I think America's guarantee of religious freedom, so the separation of church and state and the kind of environment that it's created over the last couple of centuries, I think has been just absolutely critical to really the peace and the prosperity that our country is able to have. I know from my own personal experience growing up as a child through my adulthood, I think the fact that it is a country that allows me to worship as I so choose, and I think as you heard this morning from our guests, everyone is able to choose Islam if they want to, not choose Islam if they don't want to. Even your caller, Sarah, is living in a country where she can choose to not practice the faith if she so chooses. This is something that I think is enormously important. I think it's been a common theme of all of our remarks this morning, and it's something that I think motivates my colleagues, my fellow American Muslim lawyer colleagues, particularly in this post-September 11th environment, that we certainly firmly believe that the American democracy and its guarantee of freedom, justice, and equality for all is probably the finest experiment in democracy that's been known to the world. And we want to do our part to really defend those founding principles, because we recognize that it's taken Americans, whether it was Japanese Americans, African Americans, women during the suffrage movement, stepping forward to really defend the founding values of our country. And we know that it means religious freedom, it means educational opportunities, it means economic opportunities, and the kinds of stories and opportunities and the opportunity to live free that you've heard this morning.
Farhana Kara, again, is Executive Director of Muslim Advocates. And let's bring in Phil as our next caller. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Impressive women, and I applaud their moderate view of Islam. But, you know, like the previous caller said, you must admit that, and numerically, the majority of the Muslim world, these women would be considered heretical. And so the question is
I don't think they agree with that premise, Phil.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you survive as a moderate Muslim, and how do you spread that moderate message? And then just a follow-up question is how will you resolve the issue of the Quran, calling for you to sublimate yourself under your husband and your father? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Can I take that?
Yeah, please.
Diana Yanya. As I mentioned earlier, I grew up in Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world. And we had a woman president, in case the listeners didn't know that. We had a woman president, and there were, I think, about four women head of state in the Muslim world. And we are yet to see a woman running this country.
Absolutely.
Right? So let's get that one fact straight. And also, I grew
here
up...
Here again, there's a difference between the Arab world, though,
correct,
and Muslim
but Islam
women.
Is the largest... Yeah.
I'm saying, I mean, you're all from Asian backgrounds,
correct.
And there is a difference that needs to be at least noted in terms of
but I also,
women going being in high places and being heads of state. Yeah, sorry.
Yes, I think we also need to distinguish between culture and religion. And I think a lot of Americans probably confuse Islam with Arabs, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to Islam with being a universal religion. If you look at Asia alone, 600 million Muslims in Asia.
Huge numbers in Africa as well. And one should add that there are many Americans who think that Iran is an Arab country, which it is not.
Right.
It's largely a Shia country, in fact. And let me go to more calls here. Simran joins us. Morning.
Yes, good morning. My question is, I guess, more for Amra. You know, she mentioned that her work is sort of the first time that there's been a global forum, even maybe for extremist voices. And I just kind of wondered how it differs from, you know, other forums like Global Voices in providing a way for perhaps misrepresented communities, such as the Muslim community, to make their voice heard.
So All Voices about giving everyone a voice. And when I say it's an open, unedited platform, it really is an unedited and open platform. So Global Voices or any of the other, citizen media platforms are out there. It's, you have to be invited to come and write on those sites. You have to be a blogger that some editorial people have to go through and see what your writing is before you write on those platforms. So All Voices is truly unedited. We let anyone anywhere in the world report, whether
so
it's from a cell
says,
phone.
We want jihad on the United States. We want to take action against the United States.
So, you know, if they write that, that's not a report. That's not news. It'll go up on the site, but then how do they sift up? How do they rank higher up? It depends on the community. If we try to weave and say, okay, as soon as someone sends us this report, is out of all the news feeds that exist in the world, over 4,000 news feeds, we look at the blogosphere, we look at all the images, and we put all the activity around the user report to provide a context and multiple point of view. So that's what we do at All Voices. Anyone can report. We weave all the other activity and let the community then decide what they want to add and share to get a discussion going. So if anyone wants to write about that, you know, let's get the discussion going around it and get multiple points of view and rate that voice down. And that's what All Voices is about and different. Than
again, Amra Tareen is the founder and CEO of All Voices. And we're going to go to Vallejo. And Jerry, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, hello. I really admire what you women are doing there, but there's a conundrum here that keeps popping up. How, you know, you talk about being able to take lines of credit and to operate a business, and I don't think that a lot of people understand that in the Muslim world, in Islam, there is a strict restriction against either accepting or paying interest, you know, and this has just been a fabulous disaster for poor people. You can't get a car, you can't get a house, you can't get anything, but somehow you found some way around this. So what would be your advice to the rest of the Muslim world? How do you get around this and be able to operate in the world without being wealthy?
Well, Amra Tareen definitely wants to respond to your remark.
Yes, I do. Being an ex-venture capitalist, Islam believes in business, my friend. And you know what? They believe in equity, not an interest. So venture capitalist, I want us to start a global venture capitalist firm for Muslim women and men so we can give equity and be part as a business partner as opposed to giving debt to someone. So I agree with you that people there do not have access to capital, but our goal in life is to provide them with access to capital because this is a global world and business is getting global. So there should be business and financial institution available to those people if they want to start their own businesses.
There's also, you have to, Shairoz here, a little bit of context when, again, I mentioned this earlier, the Quran was written in a certain day in a certain time. And now we're in hundreds and thousands of years later. It's time to adapt. And so you take the pillars from the Quran and you apply them to the life within which you live.
You see it as a dynamic, fluid
100%.
Book, I
mean,
of faith.
I don't live in a world where Sharia law was practiced. I lived in Canada, and I'm an equal citizen to get a line of credit to pursue my dreams. I mean, I think it's pretty simple.
And you needed that line of credit because you came here with only a backpack.
You
right?
Betcha.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
What are you going to say, Amra Tareen?
I'm going to say, you know, with all these microcredits, those are high interest loans that are being given to the entire
sure.
Muslim world.
Sure.
And, you know, it's 20% interest as opposed to what we would get here by going to a bank.
So. I'm going to read some emails. This is Chadni, and she says, I am a hijab working professional for HP Software Marketing. I have been wearing hijab for a year now, and I'm the only Muslim in my department. It has given me a sense of liberation to practice my faith and still be able to assimilate with a professional world. It is not hard to pray at work. If we show that it is hard, yes, it will be viewed as something difficult, but if we show that it is part of us and we are proud of it, people respect that as our identity. Another listener says, last year, my wife and I spent several weeks traveling throughout Indonesia and Bali and so forth. We saw Muslim women covered head to toe, others dressed in purely Western style and a lot in between. We had young Muslim women running up to my wife begging to be photographed with her as if she were a rock star. At all times, all the Muslims we encountered treated us warmly. We did feel sorry for the women who were so covered up in hot, humid weather comparable to Houston in the summer. Okay, and here's another listener, Jim, who says, can your panelists give their perspective on the following? The application of Islamic law voluntarily and outside the application of secular law, similar to how Jews use Hebraic judges to settle certain matters. The only perhaps irrational fear I have about the growth of Islam in the United States is that someone will want to define separate rights and obligations that will infringe on our existing, though battered, freedoms. Farhana?
Yeah, and that last one, I'm just trying to... I'm just trying to remember this exactly. I may be wrong about this, but I believe there might be some cases in mediation or arbitration situations involving like family law type disputes where I think religious law, might even be Talmudic law, can be used. I have some vague notion about
that. One thing
that
comes to mind is Indian law, for example. I mean, which Native American laws, which operate in a separate category often from tribal law, in other words, from American law.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think, and again, I'm not an expert on the whole set of Native American laws and also the sovereignty issues between the United States and those Native American nations, but I think that might be a separate issue. It's a function of the particular nature of the sovereignty of those Native American communities vis-a-vis the United States. But in terms of within the U.S. and whether you can assert a religious law, whether that's Islamic law, Talmudic law, you know, biblical law, you know, whatever it might be, as a general matter, you cannot do that in U.S. courts. And I believe though there might be some more private settings where parties may agree. And again, I'm thinking kind of mediation, arbitration type situations where that perhaps can
well,
be
we were
agreed to.
Talking but. About sovereignty and credit and money and all of these kinds of things brings up the whole issue, and I know you had done some work on this, I believe, of contributions to charitable organizations after 9/11 that came under great scrutiny because of concern that the money was being funneled into, you know, terrorist organizations or sent to Hamas or, you know, Hezbollah or whatever. I'd like your reading on this, because a lot of Americans are concerned, and there were real reasons to be concerned about this, and yet there's a sense that these operations want to not necessarily be violated or monitored too carefully, shouldn't have Big Brother coming into their mosques and so forth.
Right. Well, I think there's – I think that the fear and the concern that the American Muslim community has, though, is that there's been a lot of very aggressive enforcement activity by the federal government without the facts to actually – I think merit such aggressive action, and specifically the 9/11 Commission report. So this is the National Commission that was investigating the 9/11 attacks, actually did not find that a U.S.-based charity was any way involved with the attacks or was involved in funneling money to Al-Qaeda. So there has not, and to date, there has not been shown a U.S.-based charity that has funneled money to Al-Qaeda. So the concern from the American Muslim community is our charities have not been used in that way, and yet our charities are coming under scrutiny. And the reason it's a real concern is twofold. Is one is charitable giving, zakat in Islam, is a religious obligation. It's one of the core obligations of being a Muslim. And the second reason it's a concern, and particularly to my colleagues at Muslim Advocates, is that we see the need to support our own institutions, whether it's mosques, social service organizations, international aid organizations like Dion's group. We see that as absolutely critical to our continued participation and integration into American life. We need to be able to support our institutions as vehicles to really fully engage in civic and social life. And so, and there's been this chilling effect on donors as well as on the activities of these organizations because of these law enforcement policies.
Well, we're on point here, I think, with the caller, at least where religious law and arbitration is concerned. Bryce, welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thanks. Thank you for having me on. The trick is this. Arbitration and mediation are private contractual matters, and so when the...
Well, I don't know. We lost the caller. We're going to we're coming to the close of things here anyway. We've only got a couple minutes left. And all of you, it seems, have a very strong sense of wanting to give a message to the public about the way, Muslim women should be perceived and should be viewed and so forth. So let's get some final thoughts about that. Shiroz, for me.
Sure. I think it's important, again, that we take to the fact that we live in a meritocratic society, and if someone is willing and able to give back through their intellect and through their competence, through their time, through their knowledge, you honor that. It doesn't matter who they are, male or female, young or old. And in the end, we all have to just, be cognizant of the fact that in the end, people are just here to do good. And if we all do good, we're all a better society in general.
Namra?
So I think I, being an American Muslim woman, strongly believe that, women, no matter where they are a product of the environment, not the product of the religion. It's the opportunities you get as a child growing up where you are, whether you're growing up in America and, where there's a lot of opportunity versus if you're growing up in the tribal areas of Pakistan where they don't have food, no schools, no development.
Glad to be where you are.
Yeah. Yes,
that's the message as well.
And absolutely. And I just wanted to get one point across that, maybe in some Muslim countries, women may not be given the educational opportunity that a boy may be given, a girl may not be, because I think the women have to also bear kids. And there's a lot of time off. So I think it's economic decisions more than anything else.
We've got seconds left. Dion, can we hear from
yes.
you?
Yes. For me, my role model actually was Khadija, which was the wife of the Prophet, peace be upon him. And it was mentioned by the first caller. I just want to clarify that she was actually the first Muslim, the first person to accept Islam. And she proposed marriage to the Prophet, peace be upon him, because she was so impressed by his character. So talk about women liberation. 1,400 years ago, we already had that. And she was also a businesswoman.
Farhana, last word.
Last word. Actually, two quick things. One was just in reference to these last two callers, I also just wanted to clarify that I am unaware of any American Muslim who's ever called for an Islamic State. I think American Muslims certainly firmly believe in the Constitution and its principles. Lastly, thank you, Michael and KQED, for holding this forum. What this forum was about was showing the American people about what American Muslim women are like and getting past the stereotypes of dominant discourse
all.
Today.
I'm Michael Preston.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.